Hello, welcome to Countersign. This is Stuart Motha. In these podcasts, I discuss books, films, and other materials with their authors and creators. I reread Lisa Baretza's Enduring Time in April of this year, and then resolved that I would interview her for the Countersign podcast. And to my delight, she agreed. Everyone was talking about the utter strangeness of lockdown and how time itself seems to have changed. The question I was asking myself is, what is the nature of this supposedly new time? A time in which we are enduring extremely new things, the separation from family and friends, the inability to travel and take holidays, the fear for those of us with family overseas that we may not be able to visit them in their time of need or if they were seriously ill. The fact that we have lost loved ones and dear friends and haven't been able to mourn them in the usual way. So in all these senses, we live in an extremely changed time. Of course, it's worth noting at the outset that the we I'm referring to that is so surprised and shocked by the conditions of a changed time is an extremely privileged one. For many people and populations around the world, the sense of being entrapped, unable to move, being incarcerated, being denied the usual freedoms is an everyday condition of life and existence. There's also a sense that time is somehow suspended. And I was intrigued to think about what the suspension of time means. And this is certainly a topic that Lisa Baretza covers in extraordinary depth. It's an exhilarating book with many philosophical insights about how we might think about time. Lisa draws on a great deal of feminist theorizing to make the point that time is made through different modes of care. And this is in stark contrast to a number of philosophical discourses that treat time much more in terms of a ruptural event, a major event like a revolution that starts time over again. And as we discuss in the interview, she discusses a number of cultural objects and works of art and artistic practices where there is an attentiveness to the forms of care which in themselves have a quality of endurance which carries an attentiveness, a new attentiveness to time. Lisa is Professor of Psychosocial Studies at Birkbeck and a practicing clinician. So as you would expect in her book and in our discussion, she returns to psychoanalytic ideas in developing an attentiveness to thinking about time. One important insight this brings is the notion of being suspended between a traumatic past and a foreclosed future. My own sense of this is that this is the site of a certain kind of repetition, but a repetition that can also be a very useful space for working through traumatic experiences if we're attentive to the nature of what we're enduring. Modes of inhabiting time, such as waiting, persisting, enduring, delaying, ending, and indeed the anachronism, the attentiveness to anachronistic ideas, are different practices of experiencing time. Each of these manifests an inertia, a non-stop inertia, as Lisa calls it. The time of the COVID-related lockdown is just one recent manifestation of being stuck in time. But in a more profound way, we also live currently in a time when the future seems foreclosed. It doesn't seem to hold promise and hopefulness. On the other hand, the pandemic has also given us more acute awareness of our relationality. So I began by suggesting to Lisa that the suspended time of the pandemic has actually made us much more attuned to our care responsibilities, the people we care for and care about, and also in more social, historical, environmental and economic terms, more attentive to the fundamental structural conditions under which we live.
I think that's right, and I think the current situation, the pandemic that has in some ways provoked a form of suspended time for far more people than usually are aware that they live suspended time, has suddenly made this idea of time suspension much more collective perhaps than it was even a few months ago. But of course what it's brought out and what comes to the fore then is how care time itself operates through modes of suspending time. Care takes time, but it also requires in some ways odd forms of time that don't seem to move on easily. They can often be experienced as quite stuck, as the kind of time in which nothing appears to be happening. And so I suppose in some ways there are many forms of those. There are many forms of that kind of time. They're not just the time of healthcare professionals, as we know, as you sort of referenced, thinking about essential workers of all kinds, but that it sort of makes visible, I guess, the way that some people's time is required in order that other people's time can be felt to be fast or to not really be felt at all. In other words, to be taken for granted. So there's this, I think, new awareness both of the time of suspended time and the way that care operates within that.
Part of what you're focusing on, Lisa, is the notion of suspended time. Mm. Perhaps you could say a little bit more about the different instances of this suspension and how you started to think about suspended time as the place at which to think about time. Because part of what we have with a lot of modern encounters with time is, of course, on the acceleration of time, or indeed the speed and pace in which life is lived. So you're really shifting the emphasis in these sorts of phenomenological inquiries about time to focus on its suspension. And currently, in this time of lockdown, we're experiencing a very specific form of that slowing down of the pace of life, the economy, the capacity for travel and so forth. So we have a very visceral experience of a suspended time. But I think you're connecting this notion of suspension to much larger themes.
I mean, you're right to notice that there's been a preoccupation, I guess, in, we could say, in sort of modernist accounts of time with speed and acceleration, and this question about whether not just time itself is felt to go faster, but also whether the pace of social change, for example, has speeded up. So there's been lots of attention given, and rightly so, to questions of acceleration and speed. But alongside that, there's also been a preoccupation, I think, with modes of time that appear to feel at least very repetitive and very stuck. And so I guess there's a sort of body of social theory that has been thinking about, in Ivor Southwood's terms, this question of non-stop inertia. So in other words, are we at the moment, let's say in the sort of early years of the 21st century, living through a kind of time crisis? If we are, is it akin to the kind of time crisis that is described by the opening stages, say, of the 20th century? And what's different about it? And if there is a difference, it seems to be something to do with this sort of hiatus in which you could say there's a sort of general condition of waiting, that in some way some of the promises, if you like, of the post-war settlement, of the idea that the future would bring something better than what we have, it is precisely what has been foreclosed. I mean, the idea that we're living in a sort of generative future, I think, is not with us as a kind of cultural imaginary right now. And so we could sort of say, I think Franco Bifbradi talks about the sort of collapse of the future or the end of the future as an imaginary. So what does it mean to live at a time in which the future does not hold a sort of hopefulness or a promise? And at the same time, I think there's been a sort of set of arguments about the past being narrated, at least more and more, in terms of trauma. So what does it mean to live in present time between those two poles? And one way to think about that is a kind of suspension of time. It's a sort of intake of breath, a waiting, in which time itself doesn't appear to be unfolding. And so if those are part of the conditions of the now, then I think it raises very interesting questions about care. Partly, how do we take care of time then becomes a question. And by that I mean, you know, how does time itself be felt, at least, to offer some kind of promise? Or does it simply feel unbearable upon us, you know, something that we can't rid ourselves of? And what do we do about these practices of care that prop up all forms of life, the maintenance itself of life, and especially life in its productive form? How do those forms of care operate when time no longer flows or unfolds? Because the forms of care often take time. They're elongated and they're time-consuming. So I guess I became interested in a set of, we could call them temporal tropes, really. Waiting is one of them. But in the book, I sort of think about waiting's sibs. So persistence, endurance, staying alongside things, people, ideas that have become out of date, for example, anachronistic practices, delaying. And towards the end of the book, especially thinking about the temporality of ending.
Yes. I hope to touch on a number of the things you've just mentioned, but I just wanted to go back to what you were saying about the now as suspended time, the time crisis, and a sort of experience of inertia. Because the other sense, the very powerful sense of the present, is of a foreclosed future in environmental terms. This sense that part of the crisis that is upon us is the time of extinction that we're experiencing, the massive collapse of biosystems in the context of the climate crisis. That's one sense in which we can understand a foreclosing of a future. But at the same time, there is a demand to act now. So there is a sort of reassertion of human agency, or at least perhaps a pretension of human agency, being able to intervene and reverse, or at least having to face the emergency of this moment and intervene.
Yeah, you're talking about the in a way, the dynamic chronicity of the now, you could say. I mean, it wasn't just inertia I was talking about, but the idea mm-hmm. of non-stop inertia. So yes. this odd paradox of time that seems to be both speeding up, very urgent, as you say, and a kind of demand to do something now about the climate emergency, and this very odd reality, which is, why are we waiting? That's the title of Nicholas Stern's Stern, as in the Stern Review, you know, book. Why are we waiting? And there is something very difficult to get hold of at the moment about that dynamic chronicity. Why is it so difficult to interrupt business as usual and the ongo, if you like, of capitalist time, if you want to put it like that, when in plain sight the emergency is not on the horizon, that is in the future, but it is right inside the present. And I think that requires something that in the book I simply call thinking. Now, what do we do about how to think in this kind of time? Because without thinking, we're not going to be able to do something called action, or I try to think about the relationship between thinking and action in a temporality that in some ways has sort of paralyzed certain forms of thinking action, and perhaps require a different kind of thinking action that we could name as care. So in a way, the book is precisely trying to think its way out of that very difficult, paradoxical suspension of both of the time of action, if you like, the time of urgency, by thinking about its undertow. What is it that pulls us back from the temporality, if you like, of rupture or epochal change, and instead seems to reinstigate something like inertia, but something that I think is very helpful within inert time, which, I mean, we can elaborate a bit more, but I come to name as actually the maternal death drive. So something within care time that is not simply about repetition and the reproduction of more of the same, but can in fact bring on something new, but not within the temporality of event, rupture, or urgent action.
Yes, I think this would be a useful moment to point out one of the key methodological and philosophical orientations of the book, and that is the shift that you suggest we should make from the philosophical orientations that arise from a focus on the event on the one hand, so this ruptural orientation that politics and thinking is often focused on a ruptural moment or an event that brings about some sort of epochal shift. And instead of this focus on the event, you suggest that we should pay attention to waiting, maintaining, time delayed, the endurance of time. So I think that's a very important methodological and philosophical shift that you're encouraging people to make. And the other predominant philosophical orientation I think you disrupt is the focus on becoming. So on the one hand, eventual thinking, on the other hand, a focus on becoming, and you suggest we should pay attention to unbecoming time. Mm. And many of the examples that you explore, many of the cultural formations you explore, are about these moments of unbecoming time. Mm. Do you want to say a little bit more about those two important orientations of the book?
Yeah, I mean, I think I want to state from the outset that I'm not a philosopher. So it's a very broad brushstroke approach to, well, it's my attempt to try to make sense of how it is that change is thought. So again, we go back to this relationship between thinking or paying attention to processes of change in situations where it feels that absolutely nothing is changing. You know, that in some ways the dead time of capitalism, that is more of the same, the reproduction of more of the same, is something that that paralyzes thinking. So I was looking around at different ways of understanding how one moves beyond that impasse. And obviously one is the philosophical sort of underpinnings of notions of revolution. You know, how to notice, if you like, often retrospectively, that something else has erupted into the same that brings a brings something other. And, you know, I guess the sort of dominant ways of thinking about that, I think in the book I sort of talk a little bit about Alain Badiou and the sort of philosophical perspective on the event that in its own way, I think, does provide a way of understanding this noticing. But nevertheless, it still theorizes change in terms of some form of rupture. And then I suppose that in another idiom, in another mode of thinking, the sort of Deleuzean sort of focus on becoming, this idea that, well, everything is always in movement. And I suppose from a more feminist perspective, if you come at these kind of theories from a perspective that comes out of a history of feminist thought, you do bring a slightly different lens to both of those issues. And I think I quote Mel Ladimon Ukeli as a sort of feminist performance artist, one of those first early artists who changes nappies in the gallery, yes. Who says, you know, well, who's going to pick up the rubbish after the revolution? A very simple statement in a way. It's a statement she makes in a manifesto in 1969. A manifesto called Care, and it's a very important statement. Who is going to pick up the rubbish after the revolution? And I suppose at the other side, if you fully embrace a philosophy of becoming, I think that you fail to notice where, at least at an experiential level at least, one might not feel in motion. One might not feel in a constant state of flux, but actually feel utterly incarcerated in time. And that might be, you know, some of the very disorientating experiences that some people are having under lockdown, for example. So I guess I was offering not something new, but a new way of noticing something very old, which is there in the history of feminist theorizing about reproductive time, which is that perhaps change doesn't take place either through event or through flux, but actually through a mode of paying attention to these in forms of enduring time, maintenance, you know, maintaining, staying, persisting, enduring, delaying,
yes.
Repeating, remaining, and ending.
Yes, I think the example that you draw out of Ukele's work, the Touch Sanitation Project, for example, where she spent several years shaking the hands of sanitation workers in New York as a way of acknowledging, slowing down the mode of paying attention to the conditions that reproduce life by meeting the people who were collecting the rubbish, who are cleaning up after us. And I think that was one of the ways in which I think you're elaborating what it takes to maintain existence.
Yes, and, you know, she was the self-appointed artist in residence in the New York Sanitation Department for more than 30 years. I think she's actually still in that position. So we're talking about a lifelong project, although I think Touch Sanitation goes on for 8 or 9 years, something like that. So one of these, again, sort of early durational projects. But what I love about that work is actually the literal, her belief in the literal power, if you like, of touch, of touching, as you said, the sort of what had become untouchable. So the sanitation workers in New York talking about, at that time at least, literally being asked to sit on the pavement or outside of a restaurant at lunchtime, you know, literally becoming untouchable because they are prepared to touch the detritus, yes. The rubbish that others leave behind, and that actually has to be touched every day for the city to be able to reproduce itself. So I guess she, by shaking hands, by literally touching what has become untouchable, she, I think she remakes the social contract, actually, in a very literal way. And at that time, actually, the sanitation department is a largely all-male workforce, but of course it is a workforce of colour. So there are also issues there around racialisation, as well as around the gendering of the reproduction of life that she touches on and demands, really, that we pay attention to. And what I like about, I suppose, many of the projects that I ended up working with, what I think I call objects, but sort of these cultural artefacts, is that they've been going on an awful long time. And they entail modes of sort of a persistent attachment to their own practices. You know, that these are artists often who go on doing what they do without very much ostensible recognition, or they don't necessarily live eventful artistic lives. And I suppose that is in keeping, really, with the kinds of modes of care that I'm trying to elucidate. So there, these forms of social practice are themselves forms of care through their capacity to endure time.
I was struck when you mentioned touching as an important aspect of sociality, because again, this is something that is quite fundamentally disrupted in the context of the pandemic. The manner in which being with each other is facilitated and generated through touch, and I wonder to what extent sociality will be very significantly altered with a sort of suspicion around touch and touching, and indeed not simply touching another person directly, but touching an object or the handle of a door that might have been touched by somebody else. So that's certainly a very significant shift. Just to mention what becomes visible in this sort of moment, which has always been there. For example, the very substantial number of black and minority ethnic workers in the NHS. This is not something that just happened a few months or years ago. It's been the case for decades. And it is certainly far more visible now in terms of the number of black and minority ethnic doctors and nurses that are dying.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, two things there. One is, of course, as you say, becoming suspicious of touch, but also the desperation for touch in the end-of-life moment, which has now become prohibited. So how does one enact a form of palliative care right now without being able to touch these very painful scenes of dying alone?
Yes.
And the other thing that's come to mind, and I really went back to in the last couple of weeks, has been Yasmin Gunaratnam's book, Death and the Migrant, which precisely charts those trajectories, those journeys of migrant healthcare workers in the NHS who then go on to die in the NHS. And how, if you like, cultural differences made through those practices of care in end-of-life situations that precisely show up how we make time through modes of care. And it's actually a really important book to be looking at again now. I don't look at it particularly in enduring time, but it's very much a book for now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other significant aspect of time and migration is the distance that all of us who are migrants have from our loved ones at this moment, and the fact that we are not able or highly restricted now in the ability to cross borders, to travel vast distances if, for example, one needs to be with a loved one towards the end of their life, or if they become seriously ill. So there is an elongation of space that is occurring at the moment, when the world had seemed to have become much smaller and now seems far bigger again.
And he's been working on a piece of writing with my colleague, Laura Salisbury, who I'm running the Waiting Times project with, trying to think about the government's terms of its strategy, that is containment, delay, mitigation, and thinking them in psychosocial terms. Containment is such a psychoanalytic mm-hmm. term that has to do with containing emotion that might be projected into us from others, but also that might bring on something that will be on course thinking. And then thinking about delay as the time, in fact, of care. And then thinking about mitigation, especially the mitigation of pain at the end of life. And I think one of the things that's been helpful for us to think about is precisely, as you say, as space opens up again, having supposedly contracted through processes of globalization, is there a way that time can itself become a container or a holder of anxiety, distress and pain at a time like this? So that actually, although we can't touch one another, we are nevertheless touched by one another, and that occurs in a kind of time that we can think of as delay. In other words, is the elongation of time only an agony, or is it at some level also an offer of care? And in some ways, that's also what the book is dealing with, that question of whether elongated time can be an offer of care.
I was thinking of Luisa Passerini's book, Autobiography of a Generation, which you discuss in your book. And that's a way in which the elongation of time allows or facilitates the possibility of working through what might be inaccessible in the past. Did you want to say something more about that?
Yeah, I mean, maybe first just a word on the term working through, which is obviously a psychoanalytic term that I suppose is one of three main modes of time that psychoanalysis offers us. One, of course, is the time of memory, which is not really an unfolding time. It's a time in which we can't really actually get rid of experience. Memory is what we can't get rid of experience. Working through is the time of repetition, of going over and over in the present tense of the analytic encounter, approaching something that one would want to defend against for probably good reason, but without memory or desire. That means without an investment on the part of the analyst as to what the outcome of approaching that difficult stuff is, and veering away and needing to come back again. And I guess I am interested in modes of working through that we can think of beyond the clinic. Although in Passerini's book, what's so interesting and important is that she runs a parallel story. One is the story of her own analysis, her own psychoanalysis during this time of enormous political upheaval in Italy.
And we should say it's about 1968 as a political moment for those who are not aware of the book.
I think it's very much about the aftermath of 68, although, I think that's what's interesting about it. So it's about what's the fallout and how can one retrospectively grasp a political moment, an event, in fact, or a sense of being part of a political generation. Only after the event, through the recollection, in a way, of testimony to an event that's passed. And I think the argument I try to make in the book is that I think that becomes possible through this odd retroactive process of working through in an analysis in which periods of time, I suppose, that can become encapsulated are enabled to flow once more. And through that process, perhaps one can situate oneself retrospectively or retroactively in an event or an era that can be grasped after the event as having been political. And I think that is a temporality of delay that psychoanalysis would call Nachtraglichkeit, something to do with the temporal drag that occurs so that things that happen at the time can't be understood in their full potency until the time lag has been experienced, because there is something developmental in that lag, that we come at the past from a different place once time has passed.
So that's the sort of afterwardness, if you could put it like that, to what comes after. And that coming after is something that you, in a sense, have to go after in this mode of working through. The other aspect of Passerini's book that you discuss is, and I think this is, again, the critique that you bring to bear on evental thinking, is the way in which she re-experiences accesses through her interviews of others who were involved in the 1968 protests and movements and occupations of universities and so forth, the very gendered dimension of that political moment and that period of time. So there was a sense of frustration but also a repoliticization in feminist terms of the experience of women during the late 1960s.
Yeah, I think what she brings to light is two elements. One is exactly that, the sort of unspeakability, I suppose, at the time of women who at some level are liberated and yet find themselves to be entrapped in another kind of way, and just how painful that is to know about at the time. It's too painful to know about at the time, that what one wants to know about at the time is the revolution. And I guess the other aspect is this reconsideration of violence that, again, sort of comes through retroactively in the testimony that she collects in the 1980s about what was going on around violence in the early 1970s, in particular in the Italian situation. And I suppose I'm interested to also tie those two things together. What is the violence that is done when we can't know about things in the present and can only know about them retrospectively, if at all? And I guess one of the themes that threads through the book when I'm trying to think about the relation between care and thinking, or care and knowing about, is the place of violence in what it is we don't want to know about. And in particular, I think we don't want to know about violence. So I suppose there is a violence that is done to thinking in not knowing, and there is also a terribly painful uncovering of what's in there, which is violence itself. If you see what I mean, there are two elements to that.
Yes.
And I think that percolates through the chapter that deals with the 42-year incarceration in solitary confinement of Herman Wallace, and the work that the artist Jackie Sumel does with him, or they do together, to continue to know about the violence of solitary confinement. But I think it's there in many aspects of the book in terms of the way that care is always caught up with violence, actually. If we think about the ambivalence of care, we're actually thinking about its violent contents, if you like.
Yes, the violence comes through in a number of the chapters, and I wanted to come certainly to talk about Herman Wallace and the project with Jackie Sumel of the house that Herman built. But before we get to that, I wonder if it would be useful also to talk about anachronism. Because anachronism is a very, deployed at a number of different levels in the book. Firstly, I think it's very significant that you think about violence in terms of anachronism, or the focus on anachronism bringing up the ways in which the speed and acceleration of modernity covers over various slow violences. There's a slow violence of how the planet becomes uninhabitable. There's a way in which we are not able to immediately grasp how life systems are becoming extinct. There's a sort of deep time that you call, that you refer to, the deep time violence of nuclear waste, and indeed the warehousing of various populations, various subjugated populations, such as black and minority populations, indigenous peoples, queer and trans populations. So there is a there's a relationship between violence that seems anachronistic. It seems like a thing of the past, but is extremely present in the massive numbers of black, indigenous, queer, and trans people who are incarcerated, for instance. And this is something that you emphasize in a number of the chapters.
Mm. And I think that's very relevant to what you rightly bring up about the conditions of the now, the absolute now, in terms of, you know, who's able to experience lockdown as a form of suspended temporality that might open up new possibilities, you know, or give us time. And those for whom lockdown is absolutely unbearable and possibly unlivable. So in terms of the exacerbation of extreme conditions of poverty or the exacerbation of domestic violence or the exacerbation, so these, are, as you say, are underlying ongoing forms of slow violence that are always there and come in and out of focus in different kinds of ways. So something about, you know, who's in the we of, or who's in the hour of our times has to be continually unpacked. Time is lived totally differentially in terms of whose time is locked up in order to create so-called free time for others, or whose time goes very slowly in order that other people can go very fast, and so on. So some of what the book tries to think about, as you write, that the term slow violence comes from Rob Nixon's work on the environmentalism of the poor, and notices again for us these differential speeds at which violence plays itself out. So we think about violence often in terms of the immediate, you know, the punch, if you like. And again, it's linked often in our sort of cultural imaginaries to evental politics, when in fact we know that violence is played out along these very elongated time frames. And I'm using a very broad sense of what violence might mean. And as you say, sort of violence towards more than human others, not just human others. But in terms of other modes of thinking with anachronism, one of the ways I try to set up the whole argument of the book, I think, in the first chapter, is about anachronistic ideas and how it is that some ideas go out of date and become an embarrassment, and what it might mean to stay close to or to reconnect ourselves with embarrassingly out-of-date ideas. And I think I open that chapter embarrassingly now, actually, with the sort of Corbyn moment and whether the potential for that moment lay, in fact, and I say now lay because it is already an anachronistic moment, but lay in the potential for reanimating ideas. I mean, even to have the idea of renationalisation, you know, of core services at the time that, you know, he was talking about that in, I don't know, 2015 or, 1516, was a deep embarrassment. And look where we are now, you know, with the current government sort of throwing money at this, that and everything. So I'm very interested, I guess, in what kind of practice of care is at work when we decide to deliberately remain attached to things that have fallen out of date. And I'm concerned about that in relation to this formation that we call the psychosocial, or the field of studies I work in, psychosocial studies, as itself a formation, a field that works with always already, if you like, out of date ideas, because it is a practice. Psychosociality is a practice of gathering up already embarrassingly out of date ideas for other disciplines. So the idea of society for sociology, the idea of psychic reality for psychoanalysis. And I, I, I sort of make a case, I suppose, about a practice of care that is enacted when we bring ideas, if you like, that we think of as now dead, back into some kind of contiguity or relationship with ideas that are supposedly contemporary, new, and of the now. And so I suppose anachronism is a practice as much as it's a description, I suppose, of these different forms of slow and fast violence.
In terms of anachronism there, you're talking also, just to be more explicit, I suppose, about the time of analysis and the technique of being analysed on the couch as a form of anachronism that is part of psychoanalytic work. And in the book, you also give a very useful genealogy, if you like, of the emerging discipline of psychosocial studies. And I think throughout the book, you have a section of psychosociality, if you like, a psychosocial account of the cultural artifacts that you're exploring. So I really enjoyed the way in which the psychosocial thread was woven into each of the chapters.
It's a very uncomfortable thing to do, though, just to note that there is something, I use this word in the book, embarrassing, I think it's an important word or so, something that has to be sort of fronted about doing that is to bring psychoanalysis of all things into a relation with contemporary forms of political theory and social theory that would view that psychoanalytic theory as itself something that needs to be gotten rid of, to keep presenting it again and again as something potentially useful is it's a kind of hard work, I suppose. And so, there's something about it that I want to acknowledge is not, that one might want to repudiate.
Why is it embarrassing, and is it a sort of association with some sort of class privilege, or is it or is that itself an anachronistic way of thinking about psychoanalysis?
I mean, it's partly that. I think, you know, psychoanalysis is a social practice that sits within a history and is developed in a historical context and brings with it its own colonial baggage and its mm-hmm. own difficulties. But I think Julia Kristeva talks about this, and I mention it briefly at the end of the book, that there is a kind of scandal, I suppose that's the word that she would use, about the idea of the timelessness of the unconscious, and that psychoanalysis itself might occupy or want to make a claim to occupy a different kind of space-time from that of either politics or sociality, that it somehow makes a case for there being another scene that is a kind of scandal and that goes on, I suppose, making a certain kind of trouble that's not easy to advocate for, mm-hmm. I suppose, in relation to those social and political theories that may well view psychoanalysis itself as propagating a form of epistemic violence, you know, something more than simply being out of date or having some slightly unpleasant associations, but something that does a certain kind of violence to the notion of the human subject.
It would be useful to come back to the example of Herman Wallace and the house that Herman built, because there's a really intriguing way of thinking about time here in the claustrophobia of time that is obviously existing in solitary confinement for 42 years, primarily because of his political convictions as a Black Panther.
Mm.
And the way in which this is thought through an art project, a set of aesthetic practices that are projected to the future. So this house that Herman will build, on the one hand, but I think you make the point in the discussion that there was a real sense that he was living in this house already. And there was something of some aspect of imagining this house that he would build. That was a place he could inhabit, and that was a particular way of also having an ethical relationship with Jackie Summill in this very limited way.
Mm. I suppose it's important to note that I think Jackie Summill would say that she didn't set out to make an artwork. In fact, it was, you know, was a talk given by another of the Angola 3 on his release from solitary, Robert King,
right.
That inspired her to start, well, inspired her to make contact with Herman Wallace. And she did this, I think, extraordinary thing, which is she took a photograph every hour of everything that she could see in part of, you know, over a 24-hour period, and sent these images to him,
yes.
to sort of, in a way, allow him to see what life looked like on the outside, but I think enabled some kind of temporal frame to be set in which it's not simply that, oh, well, life is passing by or moving on, but that time can be seen and can form a mode of communication, so that there are lots of temporal elements to what became a project, a social art project or a collaborative production of something. But so there are lots of temporal parts of that. But one of them, I think, that's really key for me is this idea of preservation, that something gets preserved in the idea, for example, of this house that's not just about, as you say, a projection into the future, some mode of escape, or this is the world that you may get to come back to, but that something inside that house helpfully locks up a political project that otherwise is under great threat. And I suppose part of what I was just saying previously about what it might mean to stay alongside ideas that might be seen by others to be out of date, but that can be brought into a contiguity with new time or now time at another time. This is part of what they do together, because part of the design of the house is about, I think, both, it is partly the celebration of pantherism. In its design, in what's on the walls, in its kind of iconography, but also the preservation of its core tenets and ideals, and that vision of seeing the future as somehow in a dialogue with what has become out of date or in danger of becoming out of date is part of what I think they intuitively do together in building a house that, as you say, he both lives in the present, in an imaginary form, and a house that I think Jackie would one day like to build as a resource centre and a place where she can continue the work of prison abolition, which is what, as an artist, she's committed to.
Yes, and I think this staying alongside connects and is connected to the work of Christina Sharp.
Mm.
In her wonderful book, In the Wake, on Blackness and Being, which you discuss at a number of points in your book. And the key question that Christina Sharp asks, along with Sadia Hartman, is what does it mean to live in the wake of slavery as an experience of time we see in a number of the instances that you're also referring to in the book, the warehousing of populations, the placing of large numbers of indigenous, black, trans populations in prison in the hold of the slave ship, as it were, that it reinvokes that time of being in the hold and being captive and transported and traded. I wonder about how this attentiveness to the past, as well as the current manifestation of racial violence, is present in the example of the house that Herman built, as the sort of example that you explore it through, but also in a number of the other examples of being attentive to time. Did you want to say a bit more about that?
I mean, I think you're right that, I mean, the book is an extraordinary book. I felt very lucky to have found it, I suppose, or come across it in that very final part of writing Enduring Time. And I think you're right that she asked the question, what does it mean to live in the ongoing aftermath of slavery? But I think she also is simply saying, we do. We do all live in the wake, although we live it, of course, differentially. And what is so important, I think, in the in her book is, again, the kind of nexus she draws between enduring, knowing that we live in the wake of slavery, and that knowing and the enduring of that knowing as a form itself of care. So she makes that link in the book, in fact, between care as a form of thinking, as a decision to know something and to go on knowing something without resolution and without end. And I think that is what bubbles through many of the practices of care that I look at in the book. I try, I suppose, by the end of the book, I realise retrospectively I have been talking about something like care without ending in relation to punishment without ending, which is what solitary confinement for 42 years is, or what care, you know, maintenance of others, of the lives of others without ending, which in some ways is what the ongoing experience of motherhood is, and what I take from Denise Riley's extraordinary work on what happens to time after the death of her adult son is, of course, that you go on in a relation with the dead that is not a sort of captured by the term melancholia or mourning, but is something else, which is the lively time of being with the dead, which I think does relate to Christina Sharp's notion of the wake as a sort of persistence of being within non-being. And that, I suppose, in the book I try to put together that idea with a kind of feminist idea that there may be a way of being alongside that is neither the sort of arduous, boring, repetitious labour of social reproduction, and nor is it the sort of classical death drive, which is a kind of being towards death, but instead is the sort of commitment to a form of repetition, a going on in the wake, that has to do with Arendt's notion of natality, that is, the capacity to permanently begin again, which I think gives us a different way of understanding what enduring time and its relation with care and thinking might be.
I'm very glad you came to that, because that was also going to be, I thought, a useful place at which we could end this conversation, which is to think about ending as precisely this moment of beginning, and natality, the focus of natality in Arendt's work, you know, despite the problems of the public and private in Hannah Arendt's work and how she marginalized labor, the labor of the private sphere. in her discussion, and privileged a sort of forms of fabrication and the making of things in the public space. She nonetheless gives us a way of thinking about beginning in terms of this newness that comes with every life. And this is something that I think is what you connect to the maternal and maternal care as a form of caring that is without end.
Mm. It's complicated, I think, how to tease that out, because I think what I really wanted to pay attention to was the permanence, the paradox of something that is permanent that also is new. In a way, that's what the whole book is trying to think about. What is the relationship between the on-go, the permanent endurance of relationality, and the ways within that that something can be gone round again and again and again, but in doing so, in some way, brings on something new, but in a different mode from that eventual kind of scene. And I suppose there is something about the permanent capacity to begin again that I think in the book I related actually to Bracha Ettinger's sort of notion of a sort of non-severance from some element of being in relation to others. That if we are sort of born, if you like, out of a situation in which our even pre-birth kind of becoming has occurred only because it is a co-becoming. There is both a maternal body and that is evolving as a human subject evolves, so that there's always a kind of witness that we can't get rid of, we can't rid ourselves from it, we can't separate from it. Then in some ways we have a notion then that there is the permanence of something figured in the feminine that is not about the ways that women give their lives up to the next generation or commit themselves to the permanent labour of social reproduction, but are in some ways already interpolated into a situation in which what is figured in the feminine is that sort of permanent capacity to begin again. And I think that Arendt captures that for us as a politics. That's what's important about her concept of natality, that there is a politics to knowing, if you like, that beginning again is the permanent state we're in.
Thank you, Lisa. That's a really terrific place to bring this discussion to an end. I really found the word I used at the beginning. I really found it exhilarating to read this book, and there's no doubt many other aspects and themes of it we could have discussed, but I really enjoyed reading it and talking to you about it. Thanks so much.
And thank you to you, Stuart.
You have been listening to Countersign. Thank you for joining me. For more information, please visit countersignisapodcast.com.